Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
The late and beloved E.L. Doctorow was a frequent guest on Bookworm, and we decided, in his honor and his memory, to re-air our final interview with him. E.L. Doctorow appeared on Bookworm 6 times. This book, Homer and Langley, was one of my favorites.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm very happy to be in New York City with E.L. Doctorow. When E.L. Doctorow doesn't come to Los Angeles with one of his books, I miss him sorely. This is one of his very best, Homer and Langley, published by Random House, and I've come to New York because I wanted to be sure to talk to him about it. It's about the Collier brothers, who are kind of legendary figures. I mean, I think that most people growing up in New York have heard of these two brothers who filled their houses with many pianos, a Model T Ford, all kinds of bric-a-brac, labyrinths built out of bales of newspaper, so much so that one was said to have died crushed in an accidental fall of the papers. In this book, which is an entirely fictional invention, you've read E.L. Doctorow, you know how he does this kind of thing, and if you don't, we'll be talking about it now. Why the Collier brothers?
Well, they always stood in our minds in New York as folklore figures. I can't imagine any teenage boy who didn't have the experience when his mother looked in on his room of telling him that he was like the Collier brothers. They were icons of disarray and junk and pack ratage. But somewhere along the line, I think I felt there was more to them than was generally appreciated, that they may have had a secret life, because they basically, and this is what interested me, they had opted out. The decision had been made, however, consciously or unconsciously, to withdraw from society. And that has to be interesting.
We're watching the whole anti-empire being built, an empire of rubbish and discarded things, unwanted things. And it's kind of thrilling to watch them prizing things that no one cares about anymore, like yesterday's news.
Yeah, they become their curators of their life and times, in a way. And I respected that. They learn how to live well with inanimate things, so that there will be some future use, Langley feels, for what they have, what they collect. Whether it's the kind of clothing that accumulates in Army Navy shops after a war, or whether it's piano, the insides of pianos, or bicycle wheels, or tires. There's always going to be some use for these things, and they do save. They are savers. But I found myself thinking about the book differently at different times. For instance, one thought I had was that this was a road novel, That is to say, the two of them didn't walk along the road having adventures the way Don Quixote and Sancho Panza does, or in Jacques the Fatalist, the Diderot novel, where the squire and his servant go about. But they never moved to the Colliers further than a few steps into the park or around the block. But somehow their life and times came through them, and so it was that they didn't move on the road. The road moved through them. So I thought that was an interesting way to think of what was happening in this book as I was writing it. And of course, the dialogue between the two of them is constant from the very beginning when they're young to the very end when Homer is not only blind but has lost his treasured hearing, which has always been extremely sharp and compensatory for his lack of sight.
Well, he has told us that he charts their removal from the outer world, and it's his narrative, but his brother has told him there is the world we see and the world we project within, and maybe that inner world is the truer world. And we watch as Homer feels himself becoming closed in, first by these bales of newspaper corridors that are built, and then by shutters that are put around. And then when his hearing gives out, he is, by the end of the novel, perhaps imagining everything he describes to us, including a romance with his muse.
Mm.
Where did she come from?
Gee, I don't know, but there she was. This is the way it goes. You don't really choose. You don't really calculate these things. They just come to you. And Jacqueline, the French journalist, saves Homer from being run over on Fifth Avenue when he's crossing to get to the park, and they start to talk, and he becomes enamored of her. It is Jacqueline who thinks that from certain angles in Central Park you have the illusion of that the park is sinking, and that things are getting really bad. And she's the one, we find out, who tells Homer that he must write. As the outer world becomes less accessible to him, he has the inner world of his memories and his thoughts. And so it turns out that she is a kind of muse for him. I should say that the bales of newspaper come of Langley's desire. We don't know if it's honest or real, or there's some sort of bitter irony attached to the idea that Langley is going to create a newspaper that will be good for all time. One edition, eternally current newspaper, and in order to do that, he has to collect all the newspapers and gradually filter out the seminal stories that occur over and over and over. And that's the way he's going to construct Langley's one edition for all time newspaper, which is turns into, of course, these baled heavy objects that eventually will kill him. Langley is a bitter man, presumably disillusioned entirely or disenchanted by his experience in World War I, and he keeps finding examples of human inadequacy that he feels reflects on himself. At one point he says that he'd give anything to be something other than a human being. I don't know whether it's when he hears about the Holocaust or at some other moment when a piano student of Homer's turns in later life as a nun to have been raped and shot in a Central American town. That's perhaps when Langley says he'd give anything to be something other than a human being.
Now, this novel, comic, allegorical, political, is also beautifully melancholic and poetic. And because it is a step-by-step narrative of, you know, nowadays they'd call it entropy. I think that Homer calls it anarchy, and sometimes wonders if he's living in a reverse evolutionary state. But at any rate, it's a novel about things running down and running out and growing useless. At one point, Homer quotes the wonderful Portuguese poet Pessoa and describes himself as an investigator, a solemn investigator of useless things. And I wanted to ask you about the melancholy of this novel.
Well, this is nothing that can be planned. I mean, the tone of the book, I thought of it as the melancholy sort of snuck up on me, actually, toward the end especially. But I was kept going largely by the humor and the exchanges between the two brothers. And, for instance, Langley comparing shrunken heads on a line to people watching television. And then his riff he does on a delicious sort of religious summer convention in which everyone was very happy up in the north somewhere. There was with music and tents with lectures and people living and learning. And he as a child being driven mad by that because it was an image of heaven and which he could not tolerate. So I thought that I was carried along by the humor of their exchanges and the wit. Homer being pretty reflective too and very capable of commenting on his brother's behavior with a certain kind of affectionate humor. But the melancholy and the entropy is something that more or less attached itself to this narrative without any particular intention of mine.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with E.L. Doctorow, author most recently of Homer and Langley, published by Random House. We'll continue after this short break. You're listening to a previously recorded interview with Bookworm's recently departed friend, E.L. Doctorow, Edgar Doctorow, recorded in August 2009. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with E.L. Doctorow about his new novel, Homer and Langley. Perfect, because around halfway through the novel, one discovers that this Homer and Langley Collier do not die in the 1947, I think it was, in actual fact. They excitingly live on through, as mentioned, the Lunar Walk. They cross the street from their house to Central Park to an anti-war rally. They are the first dropouts, dissidents, and they invite some hippies back to crash with them. Girls named Dawn and Sundown, a third named Lissy, a guy named Jojo, and a cartoonist sort of modeled on our crumb named Connor. And there they are admired. You know, this is their kind of people, and they're, you know, admired as dissidents. Strangely, the people who meet them like them very much. One calling them uncle, who takes music lessons. They're, for the people who know them, a source of affection and interest. It's outsiders who are frightened by their tendency not to make payments on their mortgage, not to pay the bills, to have the phone, the gas, the water shut off, not to have their hair cut. And yet, somehow or other, they are figures of the outsider that Americans despise until they get to know.
Well, actually, the way it seems to work out, they begin to lose people who are living in the house with them, the servants, the cook, the part-time residents. And from one event, one situation or another, they do find themselves alone. At that point, their reclusiveness is definitive, and they begin to attract a lot of negative attention. Even as people pass through the house and get along with them quite well. But it is a, at the beginning, what is in that house when they're young is a very elegant, beautifully furnished kind of Victorian set of accoutrements and furniture and art objects and so on. And the only difference between these things and the junk that they collect later is a matter of one's judgment, really. But in terms of the materials that they accumulate, that has begun with their parents. And it's only when they're finally alone that their full expressiveness as outsiders begins to attract attention of the city and of the fire department and of the utilities and so on.
There's the sense of the American culture that wanted to acquire terracotta horses and all kinds of objects giving way. And these are people now, the brothers, who collect broken things, and they collect them even though broken, keep broken phonograph records. And it's almost a story of the giving way of certain kinds of high culture into pop and fragmentation. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, I like the word fragmentation. That appeals to me, yes. I think that's right. After the police invade the tea dance and break things up, Langley collects all the pieces of the old 78 RPMs that they've been using for music. He doesn't let a thing really go to waste. Or when he brings the pieces of the Model T Ford into the dining room and has it assembled, it turns out that he doesn't really know, Homer realizes that Langley doesn't really know why he's done this. And it's Homer's comment that finally it becomes kind of an industrial mummy that collects dust and things are piled in it. But it's an example of Langley's having this feeling that something will be useful someday or mean something, but he hasn't quite figured out what.
I found very moving when Homer remembers a poem that Langley read him in what he calls the old days. And there's a sampling of these poems from thin volumes. There's one of Auden, there's a line of Lowell, there's a line of Pessoa, there's a line as well as of Gerard Manley Hopkins. And how to put it? Well, bluntly, that America was once a place where people knew poems by heart, brought them home and read them to one another, and that this place is no longer to be found very easily.
Well, that's an interesting interpretation. It never occurred to me, but that doesn't mean anything. It was just that Homer being blind, it was natural for his brother Langley to read to him when they were younger. And Homer has remembered some of his lines. He has no idea who the poets are at this point when he's recalling. This whole book is his memory that's being presented. But it never occurred to me that there was a sort of editorial object in having them talk about these lines of poetry. It just seemed to me something that would do, that would work.
Yes, but there is a sense of culture disappearing and being replaced by something else. And even though Langley believes that the replacements are good replacements for what's past, you know, that one pretty woman will replace another on the screen, that one genius will replace another. Nevertheless, we're in this house which by the end is damp and smelling of mildew and being run with rats, that things have an inevitable winding down, it feels like.
Yeah, that's undeniable, you know. It may have to do something with, let's see, when did I start this book? I think it was still during the presidency of George Bush.
When it felt like everything would not only run down but run out?
Yeah, the sense of collapse and the act of self-destruction in this administration might have had something to do with my beginning the book, yeah.
I noticed that there's a remarkable thing, perhaps unintentional, and perhaps I'm interpreting. But at the end of the book, this French journalist, who is also an essayist, she's not being called upon to report on anything in particular. She, too, is looking for the essence of things. And she says about Central Park that it's a place, she has many ideas, that it's sinking, but in particular, look at it, it's at war with the city around it. It betokens a time when there will be no nature. Homer, who's sort of more literal-minded in this regard, points out that all of New York was pastoral when Central Park was demarcated. She's not interested in that. She has theories, but most interestingly, Homer says that he didn't know you could think of meanings for Central Park. It was just the place across from his house where eventually they went to fetch water when the water was turned off. And that sense of this character, by the end of the book, growing into a sense that he too will become meaningful, that he'll be interpreted, is a very charming way to both talk about the incursion of French theory and, on the other hand, a sense of someone who thought of himself as merely factual, becoming somewhat aware of his mythic or folkloric quality.
Yeah, that's good reading, Michael. I really like that. But I just thought that someone from the old world would somehow have an experience or would have gone through historically the sense of dismay and destruction and collapse that America in in this house, maybe only now beginning to feel. So she has a certain authority as a European who's been through all this, of an empire long past its glory. I did have that little feeling apart from the... The scene at the end where they make love, that may only be in Homer's imagination or not. I'm not quite sure myself that there's a pianist in this hotel who's playing Strangers in the Night. And he laughs because one of the lines in that song is exchanging glances. Of course, he can't see. And he thinks that's a very merry kind of situation to be in. Someone pointed out to me that Strangers in the Night, he recalls the song from the days of the tea dance in the 1930s. Someone pointed out to me that, in fact, Strangers in the Night was written in the 1960s. And my answer to that is that at this point in Homer's life, his memory is entirely unreliable.
I love, in fact, the things you do with songs. The brothers have a conversation first about, what is it, I can be...
my disposition, when sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I'm blue. My disposition depends on you. And Langley begins to analyze this. But supposing both the man and the girl have the same attitude, what happens as their situation keeps changing and they can't quite get together on this? It's if each one's disposition depends on the other, they're doomed, really.
And then Me and My Shadow, which strikes Langley as being the entirety of German metaphysics, but is also a version, like the ups and downs of Happy and Blue, another version of Homer and Langley. And Homer says, "Langley, am I your shadow?" And Langley answers, "You're my brother."
Yeah, yeah. That's right. I like that moment.
Yeah, it's Happy, a beautiful moment.
Yeah.
I've been speaking with E.L. Doctorow, author most recently of Homer and Langley, published by Random House. Thank you, Edgar, for joining me.
My pleasure, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Homer and Langley at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with the click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to recording engineer Leszek Wojcik at the Carnegie Studios in New York City. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus, copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Mira Gonzalez and Tal Lynn are our guests.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.